I would like to thank the organizers for giving me a chance to speak here and to participate in at this meeting. And also I would especially thank the soccer fans who are now came to, who are missing the first half, the World Cup, France-Belgium came to. So today I'll be talking about atrial, my take on atrial fibrillation that is somewhat different from what other people think about it. And I also try at the end to speculate a little bit and trying to understand why, to answer Leon's question, why this Physiome project was so unsuccessful. And one component of this is their model.
I didn't say it was unsuccessful.
No, but we didn't, I would say, I am exaggerating. Okay, I'll take it back. But we were not very helpful. We didn't have any kind of applications useful coming out from our studies. And one problem may be what Trina discussed, another speaker discussed, that we don't have a very good ionic model, but maybe I will indicate about other reasons that maybe even have a perfect model, we still, the issue of cardiac arrhythmias and their treatment could be still very complicated despite of that. So, and I will come to this later. So what is atrial fibrillation? Atrial fibrillation is the disease of old people. So it's from about 6.1 million people in the US, 2% age 65, 9% age greater than 65, and if you go, let's say, 70 or 80, this percentage will go up.
What is the rest? 2 plus 9 makes 11. Am I missing something?
I don't know.
So it's a cumulative of the population.
Of the population. The percentage of population that are affected by this is just gross. So this is percentage. So although the number looks small, but it's this still a big number of people. And why this atrial fibrillation is so hard to study? Because when people get old, many things go wrong, and it's very difficult to pinpoint what exactly is wrong and what makes some people having fibrillation and the other don't. What is the difference between them? So the most difficult part is the animal model. So if you want to get kind of realistic animal model, and you, let's assume we are, let's say sheep, we can provide this, all sheep would provide that model, so we have to have a herd of 100 sheep, and hopefully 9 of them, when they are old, they will develop arrhythmia. So we have to pay a shepherd for 9 years to kind of to take care of them, and we have to equip them with kind of devices, portable, then to start picking arrhythmias when they're getting old, and then they select these patients and take them. So it's a quite expensive, would be a quite expensive exercise, and nobody gave money for that, but they gave money for more stupid things that I believe are stupid, like torturing actually sheep. One of the most used model for atrial fibrillation, which I believe is not very relevant, is the famous Alesi goat. When they take a goat, pace it, implant a rapid pacing device, and then they pace, torture this goat for 3-4 months until they develop arrhythmia, but there is no guarantee that these arrhythmias are relevant, because if you stop pacing, eventually they go away. So it's not exactly the same model. But these people spent millions and millions of that. Maybe if they would, let's say, the cheap person pays twice. So if you try to save on something, then eventually we have to do the right thing. And even a model that Salama has described, this old rats, which I learned quite recently, nobody actually looked at spontaneous arrhythmias in those rats. So what we do in the lab usually is we do what is easy. we use the model where arrhythmia can be easily induced. And the easiest way to do it is rapid pacing or premature stimulation. I'll show you a video how it looks. So I had atrial arrhythmias, but for whatever reason, video doesn't show, so I'll show you the ventricular. So what you see here, that's a guinea pig heart. So this is atrium, this is ventricle, here's the electrode, and we're pacing slowly. It's not that slowly, but you will see nothing happens.
Is it an uncoupler or?
Uncoupler, yeah. This is the standard optical mapping tricks. So you see excitation starts here, propagates very nicely. It's a healthy heart. This is from the lab that my students did. So to see cardiac propagation.
That's the apex at the bottom.
And this is apex.
Propagates from the left.
No, because we're putting electrode on the base. This is the stimulating electrode.
It's normal.
These on the left. On the right, sorry.
You're right. On the right side, yeah. So now we see the same heart, but pacing much faster. Oh, now you see things started happening. You already see rotating spiral waves. But if you see very carefully, you can see a bubble from the tip of electrode going up. So to initiate this rapid pacing, the heart actually is not equipped to go that fast. So normally, let's say even look at human rates. A very trained athlete's heart rate will go, let's say, 200 beats per minute. What is it? It's about 300 milliseconds. And at this 300 milliseconds, usually if you pace it, it's nothing happens. We have to go much faster to produce it. So where these high frequencies are coming from? So, and if you look at spontaneous onset, and this is for basic sciences, would be a big question, because very often arrhythmia starts at normal heart rates, very often after long pauses. And this is the picture trace taken from a real patient, and what you can see, huge pause, no activity, and then this pause. After that pause, you have tachycardia. And this is called weak sinus node syndrome. And it's very common. It's for old people, again, they have that. And usually treatment is a pacemaker. So very...
Before, at the beginning of that trace, you say that's a sinus rhythm?
I don't know where they hear the sinus rhythm.
No, at the beginning of the trace.
There is sinus rhythm. Yeah, this is the sinus rhythm. No. Then you have a pause.
Second.
This is probably sinus tachycardia.
It doesn't look like it. Probably not. This is
so human.
So, I don't know about this because you don't see much of a human here. This is probably different from the sinus, the sinus V wave.
Yes.
This is probably ectopic atrial source. Yeah. And then goes very irregular. Maybe those cyclings are relatively okay. And then this is probably some fusion of T wave or the previous T wave and P wave somewhere. And then pause. And this is the normal sinus. And it goes on and on. And then this is probably the regular sinus. I mean PAC and pause. So
I believe Hiroshi sees EKGs like that quite often. So it's not a rare, let's say, this bradycardic onset of tachycardia is a kind of quite, as far as I understand, if you correct me if I'm wrong, it's quite common.
Yes.
And actually it's interesting that there is a model, quite easy model, that reproduces this phenomenon. And this is one of my papers, actually. It's 89, and it's frog. So if you take a frog, isolate the vagal nerve, like where is Matt? Matt is here. Okay, and then you pace. This is the pacing of vagal nerve, it's 10 hertz for a few seconds. And then you elicit SA node. These are electrograms, and then you elicit a pause, And after this pause, the first beat starts very rapid tachycardia. So you see this, for frog, it's very fast, because the frog heart rate is much slower than 1 second. So it's very fast arrhythmia. And this is actually, this model was developed in Moscow in the Institute of, it's quite an interesting story, in Chazov's Institute. Chazov was a doctor, cardiologist of Brezhnev. And so Brezhnev built for him a huge institute in Moscow, equipped, very well equipped, and one of his, people under him, or his collaborator, was Professor Rosenstrauch. He is now the member of Russian Academy of Sciences, and he is the first author on that paper. But I knew that they have this model, and I just built a mapping system, and I just wanted to see what this model is. And by the way, this was my first paper in circulation research. So, and what we discovered there, that if we, let's say, this is the normal sinus beat, but if we map one of the beats here during tachycardia, so isochronal map shows a very nice rotor that is forming in the frog's atria. And frog's atria model is beautiful. You can put it in the refrigerator, you have it in a petri dish, pinned, and then it stands in the refrigerator, stays overnight. In the morning you come, you can continue. You don't need any perfusion, you don't need anything. So wonderful model. But okay, and that was 89. In 1990 I came to the U.S.
That's far away. This is probably meanders during that.
Yeah, I'll show you in a moment more. But what really happened?
Self-terminates.
Self-terminates, you see this. But let's see what the mapping showed. The next slide show what really was happening there. And what's happening there, this is the first, the last beat before, let's say, pause. And what really happens in the frog, it doesn't, at least you don't see it in other animals. Is that the formation of large stimulation of vagus blocks the entire area where there is no propagation. So you see this is propagation, and this hatched area is where there is no propagation. So this is the situation, I don't remember the details, this is very funny, we use them. See what happened. As this, so you stimulate the vagus, then you stop stimulation. Gradually, acetylcholine gets depleted, and this area will start gradually recovering. And this is what's happening. The channels are forming this kind of uncoupled region, or kind of non-conducting region, and this is excitation tries to go around. There are islands are forming, and sometimes, and this exactly, it can form a reentry loop during that time. And this is, you get, and then the this islands disappear eventually, and everything becomes excitable, but still acetylcholine level is high, the action potential is very short, and then you have this beautiful rotors.
Why isn't it conducting that region again? What's the
region is not conducting because of vagal stimulation. Vagus,
what's the physiology?
Too much IK1. Too much IK1. So you hyperpolarize the membrane and it never reaches the threshold.
I'm trying to put together this and the talk yesterday where for sympathetic there was a time constant of activation and recovery, but for the vagal it was step-like.
Maybe it's the difference between cold-blooded and warm-blooded?
Cold-blooded, warm-blooded.
Because here it looks like you're recovering...
You're slow.
...over some time scale.
Yes, yes.
So that's just one comment.
Maybe the acetylcholine esterase kinetics are different because it's cold. I don't know.
But it's interesting difference.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah. It's very long.
That's 89. It's 89. This is another picture from the same.
Did you bring the heart with you when you came to the U.S.?
No, but you see, it's an interesting story related to this. This guy, actually, I built a system set up to measure this. And Rosenstrauch at that time was the head of US Russian program, collaborative program, and I thought, okay, we'll collaborate, maybe we'll get something, maybe we'll go to the US, maybe we'll see something. But it didn't happen. This work was done in 87, it took us 2 years to publish it.
And so you stimulated the vagal nerve for how long? Or did you say there are
10 seconds, about 10 seconds. And this model actually was developed by his teacher, not Rosenstrauch himself developed that model. It was known for a while. So this, but at that time people didn't worry that much about clinical relevance. So
clinically, does it happen? This just discharge of acetylcholine.
I will show you in a moment clinical data too. So okay, we're. Okay, I'll show you the in one experiment we actually caught the onset of this rotor. So this is the area that is disappearing, this blocked area, this normal conduction. It's kind of getting into this area, and then during one, because recovery actually when it starts, it's quite quick. So it kind of forms a loop, and then we'll get rotor here.
What's the time scale between those different maps? You were saying that there's some recovery.
I don't know. This was a long time ago. I don't remember. Okay. But this is the picture. Gives you roughly the if you go back to this scale. This is for how long it's nothing happens. You see, it's about 5-6 seconds.
And it spontaneously terminate once there is no more.
I believe it terminates when the refractory period becomes too long, because the acetylcholine goes away in frog, it's huge effect.
When the anatomical anchor that was the, well, it's not fully recovered, right, where it's still hyperpolarized.
So at that time, our resolution was not, right. If we would
it's
repeat this.
Mapping. This is a micro-micron. So.
No, it's a multi-electrode mapping. It was a pain. Extracellular recording, electrograms. Actually, Alexei Zaitsev, if someone knows, he did this when he was still a student. He did this experiment. So now, 10 years later, 1998, the groundbreaking paper from Michael Hassager and his group, and spontaneous initiation of atrial fibrillation by ectopic beats originating in the pulmonary veins. And you would be interested to see the original recordings. So look at this. These are leads 1, 2, 3. And this is recording from left superior pulmonary vein. And this shows the spontaneous onset. And you can see that was no fast rate, nothing. It was a quiet, kind of, it's quite a long pause. And then suddenly, this activity he discovered, suddenly this rapid activity originating in pulmonary vein. And yesterday we discussed with Hiroshi, to me it's, a big surprise. It's not clear how did he, why he went to look for pulmonary veins. How did he discover that it's coming out from there? Because there are several difficulties there. And this is his statistics. So how often it happens, and you see sometimes it happens in right atrial, but majority of cases it happens in left atrium in one of the four pulmonary veins. This number is statistics, how often he observed the origin in one or the other of these four pulmonary veins. Yes?
What animal was it?
Animal, human.
Human.
This animal was human. Hassager, Michael Hassager.
They put an electrode right on the pulmonary
vein. Right on pulmonary vein, yes. And it should be realized that it was a very non-trivial procedure, because there is no easy way to the left atrium. So if you think how can the left and right side are separated with the septum, and if you go through the vein, which is the safest way, you get to the right atrium, and you don't get to the left ventricle. And to the left, there is a pass, and my students, when I ask how did they ablate in the left ventricle, sometimes they say, oh, they go through aorta. But nobody goes through aorta, because there are semilunar valves. And if you start sticking, your catheter will be caught by the semilunar valve.
Well, no, that's not quite correct.
No?
We do actually go across the aortic valve. We just have to make a hairpin curve of the catheter and push it down.
Oh, so they have a trick how to get. But this is still...
But for left atria, you can imagine that you have to, if you go from the aorta, you have to go aorta, left ventricle, come back up to the left atrium, which is really, really painful.
So where's the pulmonary vein?
So these are, okay, these are four pulmonary veins.
Okay.
But you see, it's convenient to go from here because they perforate the septum.
Yes.
And then and you immediately get in the right direction. But if you go, this is what... So I had a wrong explanation then to my student. I believe that this is risky to go through aortal valve, but apparently it's just also inconvenient.
Right. For example, for VT ablation, we occasionally do a retrograde aortic approach to go in straight into the left ventricle.
But is it dangerous to go through the aorta or kind of?
Well, no, it's not. I mean, of course, there's always a possible complication.
It's more dangerous.
It's routinely done.
Okay, thank you. I learned something.
When they do angiography, they have to get something.
No, angiography is
right.
Before.
Yeah,
you don't get it.
You don't have to cross
you don't have to go through the valve, but you go through the aorta.
But the aorta always it's more dangerous in terms of clots because the clot.
But when they do ventriculography, do they go?
Yes, they do it. Yeah, you just have to cross the valve with a pigtail catheter and then just give some contrast injection.
So, and this is actually quite interesting picture from the same paper, and this is. This shows that this is they have electrodes everywhere. This electrocardiogram, this right atrial appendage, his bundle, and this is right superior pulmonary vein. There are four of them, and then you can see it. Here's they pace, and then they stop pacing, and as soon as they stop pacing, then you have spontaneous onset. In the pulmonary veins, they have this lesser catheter. I don't know.
What about the sinus?
So here you have a very rapid firing, but apparently didn't. No, all these beats came out.
So this is a typical intercardial recording. So you have a surface lead 1, 2, 3 V1. This is the right atrial appendage. I think this is the right appendage. And then they're obviously pacing the right atrial appendage up. The fixed cycle length 575 milliseconds. Here, 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 and stop pacing and just wait for something to happen. Obviously, this atrial convulsion happened. And this is a right superior pulmonary vein. There's a last.
Why doesn't the normal sinus node start spacing in the 1380
milliseconds?
Right.
So we're talking about this 575 milliseconds is roughly a little bit about 100 beats per minute.
Right.
So I think this patient has some kind of sick sinus node.
Okay.
So it's just waiting for this is more than 1 second and nothing came out. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, I think this is a sinus, but
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is kind of linked. This is example. Thank you, Hiroshi. I had to read it. You see, I read it my way, but I was close, but not exactly. But still, the main idea.
Where's the arrhythmia?
It's arrhythmia here.
Well, you can also see the rapid firing in the atria, which is slower than in the pulmonary vein.
Yes. But this is what he discovered. And what is this? Why is there? And what is going on? So this is 1998. So for doctors, it was enough that it's there, and they already started treating patients by pulmonary vein.
And the 1 through 9 are
leads that are...
It's like a ring kind of catheter, it's called lasso catheter, and then it's going around the ring. And so you can imagine as a kind of the circumferential...
This is the lasso catheter.
So it has several recordings.
This is the lasso catheter, and there's leads. So he puts it in the...
A recording from each one.
From each one.
And then imagine that ring is actually stuck inside the pulmonary vein.
You can even stick it.
Inside.
Yeah, you can change the diameter, you can stick it inside and enlarge the diameter so that it's touching the wall.
Thank you. Okay.
So it looks kind of like the frog, but except that it's not with acetylcholine, so it's not obvious.
I will get there. What my take is about this. I already let Hiroshi read my papers, so he will have, he's prepared to criticize. Yes,
Alex. On the ring, is not exactly the same in all the positions. So some part of the pulmonary vein seems broken.
Yeah. So you see there's some special effects. Some of them probably it's not a good contact. I don't know how to interpret this electrogram, so it's Hiroshi may comment on that.
For example, those represent different points in the endocardial side of the pulmonary vein, right? And if you look at the pacing activation sequence, probably this is earlier here and going this way. So that represents the activation sequence under some RVA drug pedal tracing. So the same here. So it's different because it starts from some kind of specific region in the pulmonary vein. Probably the earliest would be probably here. I see some dot here, probably this is just dot effect. And they kind of propagate it like this. So it may be contact, yes, it's a possible it's a contact issue, but it's just a different location represents different.
But it can be also, I don't know if it's possible for you to how you position it. I've seen how I've seen the procedure, how they place this catheter. It's looking at X-ray image.
Yeah, but if you look at the amplitude of the pulmonary vein during the paced rhythm, the amplitude is pretty uniform. Maybe a little bit less than the lasso number 9, but you can use it as a baseline of a kind of a confirmation that contact is actually okay.
Okay, good. So now we can move further. So then there was a paper which I believe was very enlightening. The guys from Oklahoma group, I don't know, are you familiar with this paper? No, this is from, this is a paper, I don't know, Patterson, probably the first author, maybe, from Sherlock's group. When they took a dog, they took a pulmonary vein and tried to reproduce what Hassager's group observed. So this is they actually what they did. So to produce this, they had to add norepinephrine and simultaneously acetylcholine. And then they had a pause, and after pause, they have a very rapid arrhythmia with a cycle length 49 milliseconds. What the hell is that? So they tried with micro electrodes, and here, let's say, I forgot what they did. And but without micro electrodes during the pause, they didn't find anything interesting. They called EAG, but it's just long action potential. And in one recording, they observed this, that they called phase 3 early after depolarization. But if you think about this, but this was achieved not by adding acetylcholine, but this was achieved by pacing the nerve at 100 hertz, 0.1 milliseconds. They paced myocardium, and at this frequency and this kind of parameters, all you can pace are the nerves, the nerves that are Matt showed us. And you have this acetylcholine release, and acetylcholine, we know this is increases IKN1 dramatically. So you won't see anything like this during phase 3 period. So that was, although they're pushing this EAD concept quite hard, and they have a couple of follow-up papers on that. But Okay, but what is it? And now I'm showing another slide.
Which Ryan Edeen, what did they do?
What?
There's also a figure with Ryan Edeen, did they?
I don't know. So they tried something about reality, and I don't remember what was it, what they tried. Because you see, you have to bring in somehow early of the depolarization. It has to do something with calcium, and it was not that easy kind of to explain it. So they measured
calcium release
stuff, but this data, I haven't looked at this again, but it was not conclusive. It was not that you can make a strong kind of, they had strong evidence that it's EAG. And this is another picture that shows very beautiful EAG from paper from Jim's group, James Weiss's group, and this is microelectrode from the center of the spiral. It's known that it's not EEG, but the center of a spiral, if you have non-sustained spiral, this is S1, S2 protocol here, and they initiate spiral, and this is what they get. So you can get this action potential, not necessarily it has to be EEG, but it can be spiral. But so funny, we don't know of any mechanism of spiral formation at slow rates.
But if you really get to the core of a spiral, you shouldn't see anything.
If you have non-meandering spiral, a spiral that is absolutely quiescent, which never happens in real life, then
some little meandering.
So even little meandering or drift, you will see this. So if you're close to the core, I'll show more pictures of this. So the our hypothesis was that this is somehow we're getting spiral there. They're getting spiral, but just the question is what the mechanism of triggering. And then we came up with a mechanism, and we have even published two papers. One that nobody read is called bradycardic onset of spiral wave reentry structural substrate. Then there was another one. We hope someone will read it. It's called spontaneous set of atrial fibrillation with Christian, and it was in 2009. And this paper doesn't collect any citation, so it's sitting there. Sitting there, nobody cares. Although it's an old stuff, I'm kind of ashamed to bring up the old stuff. But if nobody read it, this is that's it's new. And then the other motivation why kind of I bring this up again, this is the paper that was published very recently, 2016, and this is from Göttingen group, and then it's called completely different, fast propagation region. As a clinician, it will turn off all clinicians because they know the fast propagation region. What slow propagation, they know that it's dangerous. But fast, who cares? But essentially, this is the same mechanism. They propose very similar mechanism. I'll go and discuss it a little bit later, but what is it? So this is the whole idea. It's called unidirectional block. If you open any classical book on reentry initiation, they will describe unidirectional block. How do you get a unidirectional block? In 1D, it's known for years from neuroscience. If you have an axon thin, and then suddenly the radius of axon increases, so if you propagate from the thin end, then the excitation may block. Because you don't have enough current to inject into wide cable, so you don't charge enough, you don't reach the threshold. So what this mechanism is just extension of 1D case to a 2D case. So let's say this is, I recapitulate 1D case. If you have, let's say, this is an electrical coupling, a sigma, so this is small. Coupling is uncoupled region, or fibrotic region, I call it. Then you gradually transition to normal coupling. So you stimulate from here, you have slow propagation, this is an isochronal map, then it accelerates. When you propagate from here, you have bidirectional conduction. But if you use the same conductances but make a steep jump, then the propagation, when it propagates from low coupling, it may block. And then you have block. Then what happens?
Diffuse all the current.
Yeah, diffuse all the current.
Excite, yeah.
It cannot excite. So the question is, how you can use this mechanism if you extend it in 2D, what it's going to be?
In paper, did you do 2D or just
1D? 2D. 2D.
2D also?
Why we did 2D? I'll show you pictures from this paper. So, and this is paper, actually. This is Zikov et al., PNAS. They see also, look at jump. And they look, steep jump from low diffusivity to high diffusivity, low to high, they have. The picture looks very similar to what we published, and then it goes down. I will discuss the other side later. So this is the structure, and I'll discuss you why it's general case, although it may not look like that. So this is the 2D extension. So here we have low coupling, and this is high coupling. So this is we're sitting inside fibrotic region. This is we're outside normal myocardium. And let's assume you have a transition. It's very difficult to imagine that the steepness of this transition will be uniform. So somewhere it will be steeper, and somewhere it will be less steep. And so if we initiate a wave in here, so what will happen? The wave will block, it has to go around this ridge and get back and comes back, and then you have reentry. So the tricky part here, you have to initiate wave in the low coupling region. Because if you initiate wave from the other side, will nothing happen. The wave will just come in, flooded this area, and nothing will happen. So this is, excuse me, what's the question? No?
But that was in that 2007 paper, and that previous slide.
This was from 2007, this is 2009. So this is how we applied it to atrial fibrillation, a pulmonary vein. What is known about pulmonary vein? So after Hassager's group, there were many papers looking what happens in pulmonary vein. And these facts that we put into the model that were known by that time. So pulmonary vein produce, in pulmonary vein, you often can see pacemaker activity, what's called latent pacemakers. There were papers, what is latent pacemaker? It's a kind of, we discussed a lot of population, different cells that have different properties. Some of them are pacemaker cells. And this is the most non-suppressing environment that supports diversity is fibrotic tissue. In normal tissue, it's a very oppressing environment. If you are different, you cannot behave differently because of electrical coupling won't let you be different. But if you are sitting here, because you have fewer neighbors excitable, there are less coupling, so you can afford to be different. So that's why this area of low coupling, and for many years when I worked with isolated preparation, we wanted always to study spiral wave, and very often we have to deal with spontaneous activity that is coming from somewhere, and usually it comes from the area, fibrotic area, from the valve area, from kind of near false tendons. It comes where there is a transition from muscle tissue to connective tissue. This is where this activity is usually coming from. And this is not surprising. Everyone who knows physiology, cardiac physiology, the sinus node cells, they are different. AV node cells are different. And to survive and to be different, they create their community and separate it themselves with the barrier, which is connective tissue. A sinus node is surrounded, is electrically uncoupled, and AV node is electrically uncoupled from the rest of the tissue. So it's standard. So the fact that there is a spontaneous activity in the pulmonary veins is not absolutely outrageous assumption. The other assumption was that pulmonary vein doesn't have vagal innervation inside. That was a fact. They looked what the vagus does, and this is the innervation ends in the proximal, or this is the atrial part of vagal innervated region. So we assume that. And this is, we have a transition when you get deeper into sleep that you don't have a muscle cell, they kind of vanish. So we have, this is the our structural substrate. So here we have normal, this we use Cartamansch model, and what we show here is the color is the coupling, you see. This is high coupling, this is low coupling, this is inside pulmonary vein, this is roughly, kind of schematically, we show what this strip represents. So this is electrical activity. What we did, we just put a pacemaker in that region that is slow. So what we see here, normally when you fire, when the excitation comes from the sinus node, it always resets that pacemaker and the pacemaker doesn't have a chance to fire ever. But if we kind of, let's say, stimulate vagus, then the pause is large because this guy is not affected by vagus. It can fire, it fires, and then it triggers arrhythmia. I'll show you a movie in a moment. So what is here again, this left atrium, this is gradual transition, will be on the right, steep separation here, and this is slow pacemaker. Let me start the movie. Oops, didn't want to start. Okay, so this is, you see sinus wave, and you can see this slightly brighter area. This is depolarized area where the pacemaker is sitting. So next wave resets, and then we have a pause. Pacemaker fires, but this sinus wave comes earlier, nothing happens. But the next time, it succeeds, and then the form non-sustained reentry that self-terminates, it drifts because we have this effect that Ira described, it drifts along this ridge until it dies off.
Is that pacemaker region absolutely necessary to make
it? This is a very good question. I'll get to this.
In the real vein, it's there's no boundary on the right side, right? So it's just going to drift all the way around.
Okay, I showed for computational purposes, assume that this is a reflection, so I just reduce the size. You can, there is no boundary, but
you could just go around the pulmonary.
Yeah, thing. But let's say I'll take this small piece, but let's reflect it, so you'll have two rotors forming simultaneously. But again, we want, because this was a realistic ionic model, we didn't have a very powerful computer to run, and we didn't know how Flavia, we couldn't run it on the phone yet, so.
Can you go back to a couple slides ago?
What?
When you showed the vein, two, three slides ago when you showed the...
Okay, I'll draw the picture. So, this is the scale is correct, this is what? This is 2 millimeters. We scaled it properly, so assume that, let's say, you take this, reflect, to take a mirror reflection. So you, because we can use a twice as big piece, and then we have this transition, we can have a cylinder.
I see, yeah, so it's like twice, yes, I understand that.
Twice.
But this is inside the vein, right?
Yeah, well, again, we don't know exactly where it is. We'll place it there.
But it's an excitable tissue in the vein?
Yes, and this is the fact that actually is well established, that the sleeves, this is why pulmonary vein are kind of the why it's happen in pulmonary vein. Because pulmonary vein in humans, and Roshi will correct me, they have this excitable tissue inside.
Yeah, at the very the region close to the ostium. Yeah, you have some excitable. So how far up do the excitable tissue?
Not much.
In human carp, probably a centimeter or two.
Oh, that's enough.
And so, and those cells being in the electrophysiology.
Some, there are a couple of papers.
There's a beautiful paper from Stanatel.
Yeah.
In lab maps with microelectrodes.
Yeah.
And you can see not only the activation, but the resting molecular potential of the sleeve is much higher. So one of the activations that can produce the reentry is that the potential higher can initiate that.
The polarization.
From the lower sleeve.
You can have a focal.
Focal.
So it's very nice. So they're smaller, the action potential is even smaller. But also much higher resting molecular potential.
But your mechanism presumably would work also if the pacemaker inside the pulmonary vein would be faster than the sinus.
Yes, exactly. So this I'm coming to this. Yeah. So when I have a section.
Common situation.
common situation. So the fact is that all you need is this thing inside sitting far earlier than the sinus node. And what is it? It doesn't matter. You might have DAD guy sitting there, or you might have even EAD guy sitting there. And EAD is dangerous. Let's say we are making big fuss about EADs, but they are dangerous only when there are very large pauses. And many patients don't have these pauses. You don't have a 3-second pause to have this auto oscillations, because if this patient, let's say, the given individual doesn't have very slow heart rates, never has, because some people have higher heart rates, and for person with very slow heart rates, bradycardic, you won't prescribe the drugs that actually IKR blockers. But the others that never have this long RR intervals, that's why I'm coming. Let's discuss this a little bit later, because.
But on this line, this is an evolutionary problem, because the cells are excitable there also in physiological conditions. Then the heart rate variability is also in physiological.
Physiological, yeah. This.
So now, why should be there? They are there, we know. There is a remodeling. We know if there is
this is the point I was trying to make, Alessio, and this area is very tolerant, this low coupling area. It's very tolerant. But if you have any diversity, like Trina was talking, you say we have different cells. So if something wrong, odd, is present, so it will manifest in this area and won't manifest anywhere else. This is what I'm trying to say. So you may have, let's say, 1% of these cells, so 0.5% of these cells. So and if they are present in that area, they will manifest themselves. If they are in working myocardium in the atria, because the other cells will suppress them and they will never do anything, any harm. This is what I believe is makes this antiarrhythmic treatment, antiarrhythmic, so complicated. Because you have an oddball sitting there, and we have a very nice model that describes the general case, and it has nothing to do to what we need to treat this condition. So this is a different take on kind of, it's not a standard take on that problem, because it's kind of puts in a different perspective.
So earlier you showed the slow to fast conduction being fibrotic tissue to normal tissue.
Yes.
So here is different, but it's the same concept, but it's you're going from a pacemaker region that doesn't have vagal innervation to a region that has vagal, and so the vagal is just stronger IK1, right?
Yes.
So the coupling is not really by gap junction, presumably would be the same, or the effective coupling. It's just that the stronger IK1 also diffuses the current and has a similarity.
Yes, it helps. IK1. So with IK1 helps. So if you have sub-threshold kind of sub-threshold step, you give more IK1, you have the condition, the criticality condition, it's easier to meet. Is it clear? So because you have less, you have higher threshold that you need more current. And if you don't have it, so it's so I have a plot actually showing
it's
this.
A bit deep, it's actually not to a stronger conduction, it's sort of to a less excitable in this case.
This is the isochronal map, and this is the actual action potential that we're getting with this model. So this is the sinus beat, and this is the first. Wait a second.
Could it be that even without the vagal, that it's just that the
Yeah, well, I'm getting to generalization.
Just wait a minute. It could just be that the coupling is different.
Yes, yes, yes. This is kind of we can modulate. You see, you put a framework of kind of, and then you can do different variations. And what I believe is different patients have different kind of different situations, and that why each patient requires individual treatment, individual drug, and sometimes you need to do, well, I'll speak a little bit about this. So this is the first rotor, this is sinus bead, this is ectopic bead, and this is spiral initiation. So it blocks here, it propagates around here, it penetrates into the normal region, and it goes around. And this is, you see, the core is drifting. And this is, these are 3 points, A, B, C. And this is what you see. Depending where you record, you can see different activity, and some of them somewhat reminiscent. This from the pacemaker region, this is somewhat reminiscent to what the Oklahoma group observed. And if you look even more carefully with the microelectrode, you can find very nice EEGs. You can find, and then you can see calcium abnormalities. You can find anything what you want to do that looks like something wrong on the cellular level, but it isn't. So here we assumed unchanged, what?
Angry.
So it's a spatial effect. So this is what the question that Alan raised: what the vagus nerve does. And actually, you may have subcritical transition. So the wave, this step is not sufficient to produce a block. This is kind of, you have this pacemaker; it fires, but the wave overcomes this barrier, and then you don't get anything. But when you increase vagal tonus, you increase IK1 in this region, and then this step becomes supercritical, and then you have a block, and then you may start. And this is how this kind of effect of the critical ratio, and you can see as you add IK1, increase conductivity, then this becomes less critical, so it helps. So
is it possible that the vagal tone alone could create the vinyl block and without, and then create the spiral wave without this effect of the ectopic?
Yeah, so I'm coming to this, just keep, don't let me forget about this, because I'm coming to this.
It looks like so far, I mean.
You need something to trigger it. So something needs to trigger it. Okay, so some people may say, okay, you very conveniently kind of adjusted parameters, you make a right step, you make this right smooth transition, you put a pacemaker in a convenient location, okay, you've got it. But is it real? Does it really happen? This example, unfortunately, the experimental proof of this concept is quite difficult, because you cannot control the structure, and it's very difficult. Maybe eventually molecular biologists will kind of help us to kind of, but unfortunately, this is why I always, since I arrived to that kind of mechanism, I wanted to work with clinical, because they don't have, because if in our experimental model we have 10% animals have this condition, it's economically impossible. And they have all cases. As soon as you have, the all patients are there. So they have all these cases. And if we can do something looking at people.
Presumably, from this monophasic action potential recording in patient, you can get conduction velocity in those two regions?
Could be a little bit difficult, because in order to get the conduction velocity, you have to have a multiple measurement points simultaneously.
Yeah.
And we're talking about very, very tiny regions.
Yeah.
So it's not routinely done. You have, for example, most of a catheter is a linear structure, right? So you can measure some one-dimensional conduction velocity, but not in two-dimensional.
So the you described this new catheter that actually...
There are some new catheters which might allow us to actually look at the two-dimensional conduction valves. But it's not
really... You only need one-dimensional perpendicular going from the plane down into the tree.
Yes, it is possible if you know exactly which direction you want to go.
Yeah.
So maybe that kind of direction.
A little interesting to look. Yeah. So we are talking to, I was even planning to maybe to visit Hiroshi if he will, if he won't be busy. Because doctors, they when they are out of their standard setting, they are willing to discuss with you stuff. They have time, but when they have a patient on the table, just get out of here. Okay, so what is, I believe, although this is a very special model, looks like a very kind of, very, I would say, specific and kind of artificial model. In fact, it isn't. And I'll tell you why. Let's assume every person, it's known that they have fibrosis, every people have patchy fibrosis, but nothing happens. But I believe it's selection. So people who don't have that condition don't have arrhythmia, and we don't know anything. Let's say they live peacefully and they don't have any problem. The very few that have that bad combination of parameters, they are in trouble. And this is a little bit changed the perspective. It's not just, okay, this is why I had difficulty publishing this paper. Finally, I published this paper in some, I tried heart rhythm. This is 2007. I'm trying to publish this before I got published in conference proceeding. This is where it was published eventually. But in a regular journal, this was never published. And I never got some kind of criticism that I would, let's say, or maybe it was my fault I was unable to kind of...
What fraction of AF come from the pulmonary vein clinically?
It's thought to be probably 70-80%. You saw that the original description of it has here, and then the vast majority were coming from pulmonary vein. There are a couple dots on the right side as well, but the vast majority is thought to be coming from pulmonary vein.
But then what about this MACE surgery?
But this is persistent. We're talking about paroxysmal. It's for statistics for paroxysmal.
This is for paroxysmal.
This is all for paroxysmal. For persistent, they don't know where it's coming from. Okay, so now generalization. I promise the kind of, this model can be readily generalized. What is our substrate? Substrate, we need a transition from normal to poor coupling, or any fibrotic patch or transition. So it may be any, in principle, it can be anywhere where we have a transition from working myocardium to connective tissue. So now, what is the trigger? Trigger we use, here I used a very specific trigger that was a latent pacemaker. So the cell just slowly kind of, but it doesn't have to be. DAD, it can be DAD trigger, the trigger that actually is triggered by high frequency. It's known that if you have this calcium overloaded, then you pace fast, and then you stop pacing, your sinus node slows down, but let's say the person exercises, let's say. You go, your rate goes fast, then physiologically it goes down, but this DAD trigger still remembers this fast pacing and fires inappropriately, and it can trigger it. It can be EAD trigger. An EAD trigger could be quite difficult to distinguish between the situation when there is no EAD. But the question now, getting to Hiroshi's question, can you do without a trigger? The answer is yes, but it will be more difficult. So the actually paper that from Göttingen, they didn't have a trigger. So what did they do? So you already saw the picture. So in my model, in our model, what, let's say, if you have a, let's say, this low coupling area, and we look at the profile, so we have normal profile. Oh, okay, sorry. Not everyone can see that. I will do on it. Can everyone see that? Okay, so you have a slow conduction area. Let's take profile. So in our case, it's this area where we have steep transition, and this area where we have more gradual transition. And our source is sitting somewhere here. So this is our picture. And here we have a pacemaker. So this is our case. Is it clear that this is...
You label the axis.
Okay, this is axis, and this is... this is coupling, G... What's that? G diffusion, okay. We are using conductance. This is diffusion, and this is X. And this is... So can you associate that this is the same case that I showed? It's the same case.
You have y-axis on the top. No. Okay, this is where you have D,
yes.
And then the circle, the geometry, xy geometry in space.
Yes. But I'm taking a section along.
Okay, yeah.
I'm taking a cross section through this patch. So what was the difference? And I used the other. What was the Bodenschatz and Zickov's paper? So they use the same thing, but here they have high conductance area and everywhere fibrosis. So if you take the same cross section, what you see is this. Low coupling, diffusivity, high coupling, and then low coupling. So the wave...
It's not an action potential, it's a
profile. Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah, this is good. In Russia we have a joke in the military academy. The officer teaching the cadets, so he says, the boiling temperature is 90 degrees. And one cadet raised his hand and says, no, the boiling temperature is 100 degrees. He said, okay, I will look it up. The next time I'll tell you what the real answer is. And the next day he comes, cadet, you were right. The boiling temperature is 100 degrees. 90 degrees is the straight angle. So it's roughly the same. Okay. It's not action potential, but this is their model. This is their model. Do you see it?
So if you place plane waves through this, you can initiate spiral.
Yes, you can. Because the wave comes from here. And why it's more difficult there, it's easy here.
Yeah.
Because now you have slow, when the wave hits this barrier from here, so as you go around, you have to accumulate 100 milliseconds at least, 200 milliseconds delay. And when you you have to propagate in a slow conducting area,
yeah.
So it's easier to accumulate delay.
Yeah.
And when in other case, if you'll try to induce something here, you have to induce wave from here, but you'll be propagating in the normal fast conducting area. So you will reset everything before reentry will start. So you can do it, but you need a huge, very big patch. Then you can do it, but it will be much more difficult to do. But the answer is actually is an interesting answer. So here we use a simplification of the model. So this kind of, we have this a very simple structure. It doesn't have to be that way. It can be non-monotonic. Let's assume we have something like looks like this. Then the situation changes. Oh, I'm sorry. Should we do this differently? So if we're coming from here, so we can actually block. So we have an additional bump inside this low conduction area, and we can make all this what they describe happen in this additional bump. So if you start modifying and thinking about this, you can actually combine these two cases, and it's very interesting that this actually allows to explain Leon's favorite parasystole. Because if you have, let's say, inside this low coupling area, you have a steep transition, this it may protect the pacemaker that's sitting there, and nobody can reset it because it sits on the kind of in a castle, very steep kind of walls, and the excitation cannot get in. Whenever this guy wants to fire, it will fire and it will get out. So in a way, this kind of a little bit different philosophy. And from this, how we can use this philosophy actually to come up with something useful for clinicians. And I was thinking about this, and this is the next question. So,
well, it's halftime of the World Cup. 0-0.
0-0. Wow, we haven't lost anything.
Let's watch the
World Cup, and then we can discuss that separately because this is a completely separate issue. But if this, because I presented the concept, I think everyone is on the same page with that. But now, I believe that if you think yourself a little bit, then you may come up with ideas, if kind of you assume this is a different approach to things. What comes from this is that the standardized approach to treatment arrhythmias may not work fundamentally, because every person may have a different trigger, may have different substrate, may have different limiting factor, what limits this formation of arrhythmia. And we need an individualized approach. And what we really need is to kind of provide, let's say, algorithm. If this, then you do this. And first give this drug. If this drug doesn't do, then based on the result, maybe a rational approach to selecting therapy or something like this can be helpful to differentiate between different triggers and different mechanisms. And this is what I wanted to discuss today.
I was wondering if you can maybe elaborate a little bit more, because I think for paroxysmal AF, the ablation therapy work approximately 80-85% of the time, and I don't feel that our clinicians want to have individualized approach to paroxysmal AF.
Yeah, maybe they don't, but they see the Elena.
Persistent AF is much more
unpredictable. Let's assume you are this patient that falls into this 30%. You want to have individualized approach. And even let's assume you are one of those 30%. You undergo procedure of ablation, which is not very pleasant, then repeated ablation, and still you remain in arrhythmia. And this is
this can work for chronic AF also.
So I don't know. This is what I want to say. But we can offer something. For example, clinicians, what Hiroshi said, they are not looking much at the onset, and this would be very helpful. If you're looking at onset, maybe okay. There are some reasons why they don't do that. But this is but I don't know yet what the recipe should be. But this is kind of changes a little bit the take on how to. Yeah.
So a couple points. This is just a comment. Number one, if you look at the history of medical therapies, we occasionally experience some breakthrough and some outcome, great outcomes. that's always preceded by some development of the kind of standard therapy for everybody. It's not really personalized therapy. The PVI is a pulmonary vein isolation, is one of them. When you, for example, forget about, you know, onset, just a little PVI, we get the 68% success rate. So that's number one. And number two is that the reentry circuit, which is really, really fantastic, the notion of this. But the whether it's a kind of local reentry, meander reentry, or focal, truly focal arrhythmia, we do isolate the entire pulmonary veins anyway. So it's unclear as to how this mechanism will lead to different kind of therapy. Of course, you can claim that the role of PVI is such a barbaric, the mode of treatment. We should do more kind of precise approach to attack each of the focus, for example. But that was what was done initially after this development of or discovery of a pulmonary vein focus. You know, back in the 90s and the early 2000s, people tried to go inside the pulmonary vein and affirm it, and then ended up having a lot of complications of pulmonary stenosis and acute pneumonia because we destroyed a lot of tissue inside a pulmonary vein. So that's why we kind of retreated a little bit and then started burning the white untrap approach. So, of course, this is a kind of a bias by the current clinical practice, and clinical practice changes a lot over time. But those are the kind of key points that I have.
But what is interesting, I was attending this Heart Rate Society meeting, and this figure 68% holds constant for almost two decades and the extra pulmonary vein, apparently there are sources, extra pulmonary vein, this 20-30% are still extra pulmonary vein, and if we somehow will help clinicians to identify where it's coming from, maybe by the ways of mapping or whatever, or kind of provoking arrhythmias, stopping arrhythmias. So they don't do this much, but I believe this is the way to go. If we're going after the 30% that are not there, so then we should do something. Unless we do something, then it's they don't catch this 30% for whatever reason.
So cannot. Let's say we find that kind of structure, where should we apply ablation?
Oh, this structure is nice because if you have a structure that triggers this, you burn the structure, it won't form again in a physiological manner. So if the person has many patches that actually have a potential to trigger this substrates, so if it kind of it's this time it was here, you burn it, it will never fire from there, but if there is another place that eventually, kind of as tissue remodels, people get older, time passes by, they become bad, and then you have to go and burn them. But this, as far as I understand, this technique is not worked out yet. So the most often it originates in pulmonary vein, and they have a solution for that. But if it's not there, then they don't have a solution. They try to burn here and there. Institution, they have their own kind of preferred techniques, but there is no, and the fact that it's not standardized means that it's not yet.
Persistent AFib, yes. For persistent AFib, it's kind of standard, but for persistent AFib, there's no standard.
Yes,
Dr.
Yes.
So I have a very pedantic comment.
Yes.
Which is, I'm always bothered when people show a computer simulation and name it the thing that they're simulating. So you show a simulation, you say it's atrial fibrillation. It's not really atrial fibrillation. It's a simulation.
I don't make this. I don't make this.
It was on your slide. You have a thing showing.
Okay. So this is in action, the law. Everything what you wrote or said will be used against you. This is what I teach my students.
It's just a pedantic comment.
Yeah. Okay. This is every time you send a paper, you get this. Okay. Okay. I apologize. Spontaneous set of rotor. Yeah, I would say rotor. I agree. I agree 100%.
So do you think the personalized approach for some mechanism like this would be to change the D profile, maybe gap junction?
This is what this is what Hiroshi does. He changed his profile.
I thought he just walls it off, right? He just walls it off.
Well, sometimes if this, he walls them off, but what he told me recently, yesterday, and I'll just reproduce it from your permission. So very often let's say it's believed that it's sitting somewhere in the pulmonary vein, so you have to completely build a wall that doesn't have gaps.
Yeah.
So they know that they eliminated arrhythmia, but gaps are still present.
Right.
What does it tell you? It tells you that while you were burning, you burned something, but it was not kind of sitting there. So you burned the substrate, whatever that substrate was. Maybe they burned the structure that, when they're going around, they burn that structure where the kind of the wave tried to exit or something. And that's why it was successful, although formally speaking, there was exit from pulmonary vein to the atria. There was a passage, but they burned the substrate.
I'll try not to contradict myself, but
okay.
For example, we try to create contiguous lines for pulmonary isolation, for example, or any kind of ablation. And then, some of the burned lesion will recover excitability after a couple of weeks for some reason. But you don't really have the complete line of lesions in order for you to create the conduction block, because the conduction block is, as you all know, it's a functional property of the tissue. So, for example, if you have, anatomically speaking, if you have a couple of millimeters of a gap, you could still have a conduction block. So that's another way to look at another way to interpret the data as to why.
But you're assuming that, let's say, if you have a source, rapid source, and you have a narrow kind of gap, then it could be time-dependent block. So this high frequency won't come out through
this.
Right.
That's, yes.
Okay. This can be. Yeah, because narrow isthmuses, they have this property that they may have. They have refractoriness of this, what is electrotonically or sodium channel determined refractoriness. So they may be time dependent. Yes, I agree. This is.
Well, thank you, speaker.